Exodus chapter 23. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit siding with the many so as to pervert justice, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. You shall not oppress a sojourner. You know the heart of a sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. Pay attention to all that I have said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. 3 times in the year you shall keep a fast to me. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. As I commanded you, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for on it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall keep the feast of harvest, of the first fruits of your labour, of what you sow in the field. You shall keep the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in from the field the fruit of your labour. 3 times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the fat of my feast remain until the morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you, and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you, until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Exodus chapter 23 is the final chapter of this section of the Book of the Covenant. These laws continue to refract the fundamental principles of the Ten Commandments in the different situations of life. It's not a comprehensive system, it's just some example case laws that help us learn these basic principles of justice and jurisprudence. The laws concerning slavery and rest of Sabbath are given in chapter 21, verses 1 to 11, laws concerning violence and honouring father and mother in chapter 21, 12 to 36, concerning property and theft in chapter 22, verses 1 to 15, concerning marriage and sexual and spiritual faithfulness in chapter 22, verses 16 to 20, and then we've moved into sections concerning oppression and false witness in chapter 22, verse 21 to 23, verse 29, the part that we're in now. And then there are finally some laws concerning Sabbath and Thanksgiving in chapter 23, verses 10 to 19. And it's a movement through the commandments, starting with the first and fourth, then the fifth and sixth, then the eighth, then the seventh and the second together, and then the ninth and the third together, then the fourth and the tenth together. At least that is my reading of it. This section has a particular focus upon false witness and upon bearing the name of the Lord, I believe. It's connected with the section from verse 21 of the previous chapter. Both of them deal with the fact that they should not oppress the sojourner. They were sojourners in Egypt. And these bracketing statements help to hold all that material together. It deals with both judicial and non-judicial forms of false witness. So we can think about rumours and slander, or malicious witness, or perjury in the context of a court. The law recognises the power of popular opinion and influence here as well, and the fact that justice is often not found on the side of the majority. There are dangers on all sides that it highlights. It points out the danger of instinctively siding with poor people. This is something that might surprise us. Christians have often spoken about having a preferential option for the poor. But yet, this text is very clear that there must be impartiality and justice. And we should not instinctively side with the poor, with the victims, with the oppressed, etc. God clearly and strongly opposes oppression. But justice must seek the truth and be impartial, rather than tipping its scales in favour of either party. A desire, for instance, to do away with social inequalities can be dangerous, because it can lead us to undermine justice and to serve a particular party rather than actually serving the good and the true and the just. We can start to deal with social groups, for instance, rather than with particular persons and the justice of their cases, starting to think more about who is doing what to whom. And as a result of one party being preferred over the other, we will start to privilege them when we see them doing something, and undermine the other party when we see them doing the same thing. That is not how justice is supposed to be run. Justice must be impartial. The importance of active concern for other people's property, even that of our enemy, is highlighted after this. Once again, it moves beyond the logic of friend and enemy relations and partiality to more universal principles. We must uphold what is right and good and just over our preferences, over our friendships, over our family attachments, over any of these sorts of things. And this emphasis upon impartiality, an absolute principle, is something that is an important part of the law in general. Justice must be done to the poor and the oppressed, and their case must be heard and not perverted, or God will judge. The poor man's lawsuit must be heard and rightly adjudicated. A false charge is a matter of extreme seriousness, and those who kill the innocent and righteous will be condemned. The law, then, is not a matter of kinship and familiarity. It's not a matter of social conflict, nor must it be a matter of personal animus, of vendettas, of favouring one party over another for personal reasons. It must be consistent, it must be just, and it must be equitable. The danger of corruption and bribery is highlighted as a challenge to this. It must be a society of rigorous and consistent principles of justice, and the tasks of judges, of witnesses, of jurors and other parties is a weighty one, a task whose seriousness is underlined at every point in this treatment. The bookending statement concerning the stranger is a reminder that they were oppressed. Their recognition of what it was like to be oppressed and a sojourner must guide their own practice. They have been placed in the shoes of people like the stranger Hagar, and they must act accordingly. Israel must always see the world not only from the side of those with power and privilege, but also from the side of those who are marginalized, of those who are the sojourners, as those who are poor and without privilege and power. From this, we move into legislation concerning the Sabbath year. And the Sabbath year is given for the land, to give support for the poor of the land, rest to the land itself, and food to the animals. There's a sense here that the land is a commons. It's not an absolute possession which people can dispose of however they please. It belongs to the Lord. It's been given as a possession, and they must treat it in a way that recognizes that it is never fully theirs. It is something that belongs to God, that he has given to them to use, and that they must always use it in a way that honors his title over it and the needs of those around them. The focus on the Sabbath, as described here, is to give rest to others. Rest is a form of justice. It's a means by which oppression is prevented and by which it is ensured that people who could easily be oppressed or overworked are given relief. They must celebrate three annual feasts: the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Harvest, and the Feast of Ingathering. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, connected with Passover, preceding Passover and leading to the Feast of First Fruits. The Feast of Harvest is the Feast of Pentecost, and the Feast of Ingathering is the Feast of Tabernacles. The festal calendar will be further developed in Leviticus chapter 23, and these are days of national assembly. They are key times in Israel's annual life. The Feast of Unleavened Bread is at the beginning of the spring barley harvest. The Feast of Harvest is at the end of the wheat harvest. And the Feast of Ingathering is at the end of the agricultural year. They must take the sacrifices of the Lord with the utmost seriousness and only give God the best. None of these things should be adulterated in any way. And there is this strange commandment at the end, which is also found at the end of the series of commandments in Exodus chapter 34, verse 26, and then repeated again in Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21. In each case, it's a climactic statement: to not boil a kid in its mother's milk. The importance of keeping life and death separate might be part of the point here. And this also has the effect of placing restrictions upon food that give a recognition that all comes from God and is subject to him, and a mindfulness about our food and where it comes from, and the way in which it's made and processed, and the dignity with which things are treated, is part of the purpose of this, I think. When we consider what is meant by boiling a kid in its mother's milk, we must recognize that it's taking something that was for the kid to have life, its mother's milk, and we're using that as a means of its death. We're using that to prepare it for our food. What this commandment forces people to do is to consider the dignity of the animals themselves. The kid should not be prepared for its food in what was supposed to be its food. There's something about that that dishonors the kid and the milk. And the law that we must hold those things separate forces us to consider the dignity of animal life and the way that we cannot just treat animals as our pure possession. We must give honor to them. And we must eat them in a way that shows that they have a life and a dignity of their own. Pay attention to how many of the commandments in this book of the covenant are devoted to animals and taking care of them. God created the animals. He delights in the animals. And one of the tasks that we have as human beings is to take care of and concern for the animals. God declares that he will send his angel before them. This seems to be a theophanic figure, a manifestation of God's own presence. He's the messenger of God himself and seems to be identified with God, at least in my understanding. Looking back at Genesis, the angel appears on a number of occasions. It wrestles with Jacob. It appears to Abraham and to Sarah and declares that they will have a son in Genesis chapter 18. Here we have a section of sanctions following commands. There are three warnings: to listen to the angel, a warning against worshipping foreign gods, and again another warning against the gods of the Canaanites. And these frame two blessings: blessings for obedience to the angel, and then a blessing upon obedience more generally. There are consequences for obedience and disobedience. They must utterly shun Canaanite idolatry and be faithful to the Lord. If they are faithful, God will bless them with food, with health, with fruitfulness, and he will drive out their enemies before them. God is the God of nature, and as Israel serves him, nature itself will support them. This section deals with principles of holy war, which can be troubling for us. It's important to remember that this war is primarily a war of God against the Canaanites. The Israelites have to remove the Canaanites, but just the Canaanites. It's not a war against paganism in general. They have to root paganism from the land, but not paganism as such, from all over the world. No right was given to them to fight in the name of the Lord to develop a greater empire. In Genesis chapter 15, God declares that the sin of the Amorites had not yet reached its full measure. God gives them time before he judges them. The Canaanites could also leave the land and go elsewhere. Recognizing these things can at least relieve some of our problems. It doesn't actually solve many of the difficulties and questions that we might have about this, but at least gives us a clearer sense of what's in view. The emphasis here is upon driving them out, removing them from the land, not exterminating them, but removing them from the land so that they go elsewhere, presumably. A question to consider: what are some of the ways, both in our treatment of animals and in our separation of death and life more generally, that we can be mindful not to boil a kid in its mother's milk?